Welcome to another In Deep radio show. I'm Angie Coiro. Be grateful for every bee you see this summer. They are in serious decline. Loss of bee colonies threatens more than half the food we eat. This hour, Monsanto, Bayer, genetically modified seeds, bees, and superweeds. The realities of chemical farming coming up on In Deep. It's that time again. Here she comes, just a walking down the street. It's our own. Gotta laugh, our demented sidekick Buttercup with her own unique and twisted take on the news. Oh, the week. Gotta laugh. Welcome.
Oh, the week. I nearly didn't get here on time. I was on the corner of Yucca and Las Palmas, minding my own business, writing my name on the Shell station bathroom wall. After hanging out with President Obama and his morally repugnant political whores, you know how it is. I got sidetracked. The time went by.
Yeah. Well, I hope it was a profitable moment on the corner. Yes. You're quoting Mike Huckabee to us, or are you, as the story evolves?
Well, yeah, the story evolved where they're disavowing what I'm about to tell you about, but I don't believe that for a second because his signature is on this letter that we're going to be talking about, and it sounds to me like the disavowal or the disavowitude is being disavowed because they're embarrassed that they were discovered sending out a terrible letter that was pretty much... Well, I'll just tell you that it was supposed to be this letter about we're going to be forming an Obama fundraising watch and we're going to pour through the president's Federal Election Commission filings to derail the Obama agenda once and for all. And they spelled the word pour wrong. Oh. So that's the beginning of their problems. Then the person of faith, Huckabee, whose signature is on this letter, says, President Obama... Well, actually, it says, listen, you're a person of faith, and so am I. That's how he leads into the sentence. In his administration and now on his reelection campaign, President Obama has surrounded himself with morally repugnant political whores with misshapen values and gutter-level ethics.
My.
Oh, gosh. And then he says, thank goodness for Citizens United. And I'm thinking, this is a guy who's siding with the 1%. What would Jesus say about that? Okay, then he goes on to say... We have every reason to be suspicious of Obama's shallow ethics as he writes an unethical letter that he has to disavow. And finally, he says, I'm not buying into Obama's malarkey for a second. And then he calls Team Obama old school after he uses the word malarkey. Okay, I give up. I just avowed that I even talked about this.
So, Mike Huckabee, sorry, we don't believe you didn't know about that letter. Yep. Moving on to one of our returning villains, a return offender, James O'Keefe is at it again with his videos.
James O'Keefe of little Jimmy Olsen wannabe guy dressed as a pimp, which is kind of a weird thought when you think of Jimmy Olsen as a pimp. But anyway, he's been trying to pull off sting after sting, proving voter fraud, which, by the way, is virtually non-existent. Brad Friedman will attest to that, who's the expert on this. Anyway,
he has on this show very recently.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Very good. And he's been failing and failing at proving all these different things. He's tried to have people register as dead people and then go, ha-ha, look what we did. But unfortunately, the dead people weren't dead at all, and they got the names mixed up. And then he tried again, trying to ambush people as non-citizens. Well, that's backfired now. He actually has been harassing via phone call the Romero family, trying to prove that this guy is not a citizen. By the way, he became a citizen January 2011. Oops. But after he harassed this guy on the phone, he ambushed him in his driveway and he continued to harass him. And as he's going harassing one person in the driveway, it turns out that the family member was coming home to care for his sick son.
Oh, good Lord.
God, can this get any worse? I mean, so he's trying to pass himself off as a real live journalist and an adult, and he's failing on both counts.
Wow. Okay, we're covering some ground here. We went from whores to pimps, and now we're going to George W. Bush.
Well, then there you go. Whore and a pimp. He pimps himself out. So he is now expecting us to shell out money for a book he wrote, or so he says he wrote. And the subject matter is strategery for economic growth. Oh, no.
No, it is not.
Yes, it is.
They
And here he is, you know, not realizing that spending and taxes and the deficit are all lower today than when President Obama took office. And according to Think Progress, over the last 50 years, two-thirds of the private sector jobs created here have come under Democratic administrations. And all private sector jobs lost in the Bush recession have been recovered. So my little quip that I decided to say was book schmuck from a schnook of a crook.
So George W. Bush is going to tell us about economic growth, and another man's words being challenged would be our own Mitt Romney, Mittens.
He's not my Mitt Romney. This guy is such, he's a loser. He's now embroiled himself in yet another stomp on myself during my own news cycle moment, because he rather than talk about the economy, he got stuck talking about the Jeremiah Wright attacks, that the GOP was going to do sort of a swift voting again of President Obama via, you know, Reverend Wright. And Willard apparently spoke again about this back in February after he said, you know, he repudiates the GOP attempt to attack. Well, I'm going to let you play the clip on how he responded when a reporter asked him about his February comments.
Mitt, in his own words.
I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was. And with regards to, I'll go back and take a look at what was said there.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Oh. Gotta laugh. Thank you for bringing us your usual joy this week. We'll talk to you same time next week.
Thank you so much.
Gotta Laugh's work is regularly visible at thepoliticalcarnival.net. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. Spending this hour on a look at what's happening with collapsing bee colonies, what the connection is to Monsanto and to Bayer, what's happening with the research into this and other issues about modern chemical farming. Here are a couple stories that came to my attention. One is on the front page of the Pesticide Action Network. That's PANNA.org, and you'll find that link along with all the others we discussed this hour on our website, indeepradio.com. This article notes that bees are still dying. The still being because the issue of bee collapse has been known for some time. In some cases, it appears the bees are infected. In others, they're deserting their hives for no apparent reason. And bees have hopefully well understood link to our very production of food. It's not one of those species that will disappear and we'll all say, ah, and move on with our lives. It's critical to the survival of human species as we know it. And another article that came to my attention by the writer Tom Philpott, who's now with Mother Jones magazine, and Tom's article notes the takeover of research facilities and the influence on research facilities by corporations. Those two articles were too closely connected to ignore. So let me welcome to the show first Tom Philpott, the author of that article. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And I also have with me Paul Towers, who is with the Pacific Action Network with its California division. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First, Paul, I gave a really brief summary of what the issue is with the bees there, but to make sure everyone's on the same page, can you correct, modify, or add to what I said there so people understand the issue?
Certainly. Well, you know, for the past several years, since the early 2000s, we've observed decreasing numbers of honeybees each year. Beekeepers across the country have been reporting a decline, what some are terming a colony collapse disorder, really this reduction in the number of bees that these beekeepers are seeing in their operations each year. And really, there's been this question, this mystery of what is this colony collapse disorder? What's causing it? And increasingly, what scientific studies point to is that it's a number of factors. It's nutrition, it's disease, but chief among those factors in contributing to it is our pesticides, and this specific class, neonicotinoids. They're a pesticide that are applied to seeds, especially corn seeds, and then taken up and expressed through plants over the course of their life. This is when bees interact with them. And what the research suggests is that the pesticides are not killing bees outright, but they're weakening or compromising their immune systems and making them susceptible to some of these other factors. And that's really what we're talking about when we say colony collapse disorder.
And Tom Philpott, to take this over to you, this goes right to the heart of one of your articles in Mother Jones magazine, where you were talking about the fact that 90% of the corn seeds, and of course corn is one of the biggest crops in the country, 90% of corn seeds planted in America are coated with a pesticide made by Bayer. And tell us a little more about that, especially the fact that the way pesticides are delivered has changed, so its effect on the lives around them has changed as well.
Well, you know, it's kind of a complicated thing because farmers started using these neonicotinoids as a way to get away from this even more dangerous class of chemicals called organophosphates. And organophosphates are actually very harmful to people. And so, you know, in an attempt to get away from them, Bayer came up with this. Bayer and a couple of other companies came up with this these neonicotinoid pesticides that aren't really toxic to mammals. And so, you know, from the perspective of the agrochemical industry and from the farmers, they were taking this step forward. And so they start coating seeds with them. And as Paul expressed, they are taken up by the plant and they express themselves throughout the whole life of the plant, and they get into the pollen, the nectar, and everything about that plant. And you know, as Paul put it so correctly, it isn't what scientists call an acute effect. It isn't that the bees fly over and they take in this pollen and die. It's this very low level. It's actually very small amounts of it are getting into the colony. And what it seems like, what research is emerging to tell us, is that it is the tipping point that makes bees vulnerable to these other environmental stresses that are out there. And it is what is causing them to succumb to the viruses and the mites and the other things that are stressing them out. So meanwhile, you know, this information is coming out. Meanwhile, the technology is getting more and more pervasive. And, you know, this industry is extremely consolidated. Just a few companies basically control the market in stuff like pesticides. And, they tend to focus on these big crops like corn, because that's where all the money is. And so you get a situation where, you know, this year farmers are going to plant about 90 million acres of corn, which is a historically very high number. And, upwards of 90% of it, and I think, Pesticide Action Network is reporting 94% of it is treated with this pesticide. And, you know, at this point, there are farmers out there who are questioning whether it's a good idea and would like to opt out of it. And when you get those kinds of numbers, there literally is no choice. If you want to grow corn in many markets in the Midwest, then you have to buy these seeds that are treated with it. And that's one of the very big problems, I think, is that farmers don't really have the option to opt out currently.
That's Tom Philpott. He covers education, food and agriculture, and other top stories for Mother Jones Magazine. He was formerly the editor of Grist Online. And we also have on the line Paul Towers with the Pesticide Action Network. He's their media director. Well, Paul, we're hearing about how these crops are everywhere in the country, and we're hearing about how the seeds are coated with this stuff that impacts the bees. I'm not naive about the powers of regulatory commissions in the U.S., but you would think that these companies have to prove not only the efficacy of their products, but the safety of their products. What are the regulations that are in place, and how are they missing things like this?
Well, Angie, that's a really good question. And as Tom put it, really, this has to do with the consolidation of power in the country around the agricultural system, and it has to do with that undue influence into it. You know, for example, in 1994, there were 14 major agrochemical corporations, and by 2005, there were only six left. We call them the Big Six. And so, you know, really, those same corporations are the ones that control the world's seed supply at the same time. You know, the top three control 47% of the world's seeds. So ultimately, regulators are kind of at the mercy of these big six chemical and biotech corporations. They have very little ability to effectively regulate them. And in fact, the laws on the books don't look at many of the impacts of either the A, pesticides, or B, the actual genetic engineering of the seeds themselves that allow for greater application of pesticides. This has been the big loophole or big flaw in the current regulatory system, is that it's really up to manufacturers to police themselves, and in fact, they're not doing it. So we allow them to put their own products on the market. There's very little review, and then regulators like the Environmental Protection Agency or the FDA just rubber stamp those products as they come onto market. Unfortunately, that's why we need to really break up or bust up the Big Six, is to make sure that there's this fairness for farmers, so that they can choose the types of seeds they'd like to grow, and really aren't at the mercy of these corporations.
Tom, tell me if I'm taking you out of your area of expertise here, but I'm wondering if you have any contact with farmers and any idea about how they feel about trying to bust up the big companies, as Paul Towers refers to. I mean, would they be behind that action? Do they feel helpless? Do they feel in control? How do the farmers feel about all this?
Well, I mean, I think that it depends. I mean, there are definitely groups of farmers, including corn and soy farmers in the Midwest, who are completely fed up with the situation that Paul's talking about and would like to have other options, have seen, you know, I just said that it's very hard to get seeds that aren't treated with neonicotinoid pesticides. It's also really hard if you are a Midwestern farmer to get corn and soy seeds that aren't genetically modified to either be resistant to herbicides or to express this other pesticide called BT. And so there are people pushing back. I mean, I think that the main group that kind of organizes them is called the National Family Farmers Coalition. Mm-hmm. And they've been part of this pushback that Pesticide Action Network is involved with. And then you get, you know, the other farm groups are things like the American Farm Bureau Federation, which is an extremely powerful lobby. And it's, you know, it's sort of political bases in the Midwest. And, you know, it's a group that claims to represent the bulk of those corn and soy farmers, but is really kind of, it's a kind of a quasi public insurance company that in, you know, has most of its members aren't farmers. It works in alliance with the Big Six instead of trying to challenge the Big Six. And I think that the Farm Bureau Federation sort of dominates the way people think farmers think about this stuff. But in reality, you know, there are a lot of farmers who are fed up. And, you know, especially as some of this stuff starts to fail. I mean, I think the famous example a failure is Roundup Ready corn and soy and cotton, mm-hmm. Which are ubiquitous in, you know, the cotton in the Southeast and the corn and soy in the Midwest. And, you know, farmers having used it for so many years now, over and over again, year after year, applying the same herbicide, Monsanto's Roundup, to their crops, inevitably what anybody could have predicted has happened, and that is that resistant weeds have emerged. And farmers are finding it, you know, really hard to get away from that. They're finding it really hard to find alternative seeds. And I think that that people are getting fed up. But I think that the Farm Bureau Federation kind of keeps a, you know, kind of tamps down that the perception of farmer unrest by being so virulently pro-GMO, pro-corporate. Things like that.
Wow, the parallels are amazing. As I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking of the National Rifle Association and how they're primarily, they're comprised of gun manufacturers who are focused on selling a product, but the perception is that they're backed up by all the gun owners in the country, which of course they're not. We're going to continue this conversation throughout the hour. That was the voice of Tom Philpott you just heard with Mother Jones Magazine. We also have online Paul Towers. Paul Towers is with the Pesticide Action Network, and he works here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're coming back with more on In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. Stay tuned.
Buzzing around your hive. come inside. I'm young and able to buzz all my life. I'm young and able.
Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. We're talking about the collapse of bee colonies, the permeating effect of Monsanto, Bayer, and other pesticide companies, GMO-oriented companies, throughout the farm culture in the United States, what effect that's having on the bee culture and on your options as a consumer, on farmers' options as producers. And on the line, we have Paul Towers, who's with the Pesticide Action Network, PANNA.org. You'll find that link, if it went by too fast, on our website at indeepradio.com, where you'll also find links to Tom Philpott's work at Mother Jones Radio. He covers many of those same areas. Paul, let me get your opinion on any way you'd care to expound on what Tom just said about the voice of the farmers in this, about how much voice they have and how they're starting to coalesce around the idea of maybe getting out from under GMO and out from underneath these big pesticide companies.
Yeah, unfortunately, many family farmers just don't have a voice in the current agricultural set in D.C. For instance, U.S. agribusiness interests really is a special interest lobbying bloc spent around $92 million on lobbying alone in the last calendar year in 2011. These are the folks that, you know, really represent an outdated form of thinking and a kind of thinking that is stuck on this, you know, pesticide treadmill, that we can continue to solve any of our problems by continuing to use more and more and more toxic pesticides to solve any of our pest problems. And as we've seen, that kind of thinking has left us with super weeds and super bugs that require more and more toxic pesticides. So it's unfortunately that kind of thinking that pervades D.C., and we see it because of the amount of money that's spent by organizations like CropLife that represent the big six pesticide and biotech companies, by Monsanto, Bayer itself. These companies really exert a tremendous amount of undue influence, not only in lobbying directly at the legislative level, but throughout each new pesticide or each new product that is regulated or reviewed by the Environmental Protection Agency. For instance, when Syngenta, the manufacturer of a chemical called atrazine, also used widely in cornfields throughout the Midwest, began to look at additional restrictions or protections around that chemical, Syngenta held 50 closed-door meetings with the agency leading up to that review. So that's just an example of the kind of influence and power that these corporations have and that they're willing to use, particularly in D.C. Now, as Tom said, the exciting news is that folks all across the country, individual farmers and organizations that are really on the cutting edge, that are finding ways to really promote a different type of farming, one that is truly cutting edge, one that is much more sustainable, and that's the exciting news. These types of farmers are really being able to make the case that we need to look at a different type of pest control, of pest management, one that values soil, that values what we say agroecology, that really looks at the whole system of how to grow and how to farm using a variety of cultural practices and methods. So I think that's the kind of exciting thing we're seeing. And the idea is that we need to cut through that power of the big six and really lift up these voices, lift up these solutions. And I think we can do it. It's going to take a lot of power to cut through it all.
Tom, I think
one thing I would just add.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I was just going to jump in to add to what Paul said that, you know, in terms of farmers pushing back, you know, a lot of what we know about the threat of neonicotinoid pesticides on bees, we know because of beekeepers in the Midwest. The idea that neonics would hurt bees was out there from the very beginning, but Bayer said it wasn't going to be a problem, that doses were going to be too small to actually affect them. And as colony collapse order started to take root in the mid-2000s, it was beekeepers who sounded the alarm. And one of those beekeepers, and Tom and Paul, you'll remember the guy's name, got a memo. He had been in contact with the EPA and was in the EPA's ear about what he thought was a problem. And he got a memo leaked to him from internal scientists in the EPA who were saying that some of the studies, this one main study that the EPA used to register Bayer's pesticides was a completely, it was a Bayer-funded study. I think a Bayer scientist was the co-author of it. And it was completely flawed. And there's this internal memo that wasn't supposed to get out to the public where these two scientists basically said that this study is garbage. And so this beekeeper in the Midwest, what's his name, Paul? Tom
Theobald.
He got hold of it and publicized it. And that was a real turning point in this story. And then, of course, afterwards, you started to get all this peer-reviewed academic research suggesting that this beekeeper in the Midwest was exactly right, that there are these low-level effects that are pushing colony collapse. But, you know, I just wanted to point it out as an example of farmer activism making a real difference.
That's a story that's simultaneously encouraging and discouraging. I mean, so often we hear about the regulatory agencies that are falling down on the job. Paul, what indications do you see from the EPA that they're taking colony collapse seriously?
That's a really good question, and I think, you know, Tom pointed to the fact that that EPA and up until recently has been really ignoring and trying to cover up any of the science as it's emerged, and really taking industry-funded science, especially from Bayer Crop Science, at its word. And that's been the disappointment. Even when memos have come forward from the agency that have documented that, they know the science to be flawed and that they know these pesticides, these neonicotinoids, pose harm to pollinators, especially honeybees. So that's been the case from the agency until now. When we filed a legal petition with 30 beekeepers just a few weeks ago and on behalf of several environmental organizations, we started hearing some different signals from the agency that they're starting to take this more seriously, that they expect to give us some feedback on the legal petition shortly, and so that's hopeful. We see signals that the agency is starting to take the issue more seriously, that it's responding in particular to these beekeepers that are saying, very literally, one in three bites of food that we eat in this country are reliant on pollination or reliant on bees. And so that agency, I think, is starting to take it more seriously. And the real test will be whether or not beekeepers, with support of environmental groups and with journalists that are bringing these issues to light, can cut through that power. You know, just yesterday, for example, a group of folks here in the Bay Area held an event outside Bayer's offices here and actually called on the corporation to disclose how it's damaging bees and actually suspend the use of its products, its neonicotinoid products, especially clothianidin, until they can demonstrate they're not doing harm to bees. And unfortunately, the corporation in a very public statement said, you know, there's still no evidence of harm. That runs counter to the science, and we're hopeful that EPA and even here at the state level in California, the Department of Pesticide Regulation will take that science more seriously and begin a true reevaluation and steps to protect pollinators from these neonicotinoids.
Guys, we're going to take a break here and come back. In fact, we'll take a brief break from this conversation as a whole. In just a moment, we're going to hear from Gideon Foreman, who's with the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Key to pushing through a ban on many of the pesticides that we're talking about this hour in Ontario, Canada. We're going to find out how they did that, how they fought the Big Six to get the message through to the consumer there. And we're going to hear a little bit of the bee music that was being played. Yes, you didn't know there was a thing called bee music, did you? Music about bees that was played at that very same bear protest that Paul Towers just referenced. Come back for more here on In Deep. In Deep Radio is a production of Talkback Media. We are supported in part by our listeners. Talkback Media produces discussions on key political, social, and cultural issues, available for live, digital, audio, and video venues. Learn more online at indeepradio.com. And if you are in a position to help us keep on the air, click one of the PayPal links on the side of the page. One-time gifts or a small monthly donation, whatever works for you. We appreciate it. Thanks. We're taking just a break for a few moments from our conversation with Tom Philpott and Paul Thomas to find out about a success story in the world of fighting against pesticides. Ontario, Canada managed to ban home cosmetic use of all pesticides, and in fact, a great deal of commercial use of what they call cosmetic pesticides as well, including one pesticide that is one of the active ingredients in Agent Orange. You may not even know that that's approved for use, but it was used both in Ontario and is still used here in the U.S. So how do you get that kind of regulation passed? We are going to spend a few minutes here with Gideon Foreman. He's executive director of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. And Mr. Foreman, we'd like to hear the secret of your success.
Delighted to share it with you. One of the key things that we did, Angie, was we partnered with major health organizations in Canada. We never work on our own, our physicians group. We always work with our health partners. So we brought in the Canadian Cancer Society. We brought in the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. We worked with the David Suzuki Foundation. And as a little coalition of health groups, we met with government to talk to them about the health impacts of pesticides and why a ban was the way to go.
And, you know, we've been talking already with Tom and with Paul about the huge pull and influence and money of the big six pesticide companies. I don't know how it works in Canada. I'm in California, and of course, we're a very active political state. Right now, for example, we're in a battle with the tobacco companies to pass another cigarette tax, and the money that they're able to spend absolutely dwarfs what those who are trying to prevent cancer can put in. How comparable are those two situations to what you were facing?
Well, I think you're exactly right. First of all, I hope you win that battle to bring in that extra tax. It's crucial that we tax those companies and eventually stop them from selling tobacco. But that's a whole other story. But the influence of industry money in Canada is enormous as well. And the industry, both the lawn care industry and the chemical industry, fought this ban in Ontario tooth and nail right to the end. They threw everything they possibly could at it. They tried to take cities to court. They threatened activists. They did just about everything they possibly could to stop it.
And what about the homeowners? I know that a lot of people are very married to this image of a perfect lawn.
Yeah, I mean, we one of the things we did is we commissioned scientific polling with a third-party pollster. So we asked people about do they support a pesticide ban or not. And the polling consistently showed, Angie, that about 70% of Ontario residents supported a ban on pesticides. So we very much had the public with us. There were a few people who, you know, believed they could only have the perfect lawn if they used these poisonous chemicals. But the vast majority of Ontario residents realized they could have a nice home, a nice property without using these toxic chemicals to threaten people's health. So for the most part, the public was on side. And as I mentioned, all the big health organizations were on side. And so when you have that combination of public support and health organizations, it's a very powerful advocacy group to sway government.
You know, you're in an interesting position in terms of how we're putting the show together this week, because I've just recorded a show that our audience will be hearing in the next hour, and that's with the documentary filmmaker behind Hot Coffee. One of the issues about her documentary with tort reform and with arbitration problems, et cetera, is how powerful messaging is. And when you have moneyed interests, they can put together messages that sound as though they are by all means benefiting the consumer. And then, of course, whoever's fighting against them has to untwist that message and inject some reality. How much of that went on in the fight in Ontario?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. The industry really did twist things. You know, the industry suggested the only way you can have a healthy lawn is by using these toxic chemicals. They talked about the value of greenery around a home. And of course, that's true. It is useful to have greenery and trees and plants and shrubs around your home. But they made it sound as if the only way to have that was through these toxic chemicals. And of course, they used a tactic that they use all over the world, which was to disparage the science. They said, you know, there's no conclusive science linking pesticides to human illness. And so we had to keep coming back again and again to the fact that there really is a lot of science linking pesticides to some very scary human health effects, including cancer and birth defects and neurological illnesses like Parkinson's disease. But you're exactly right. The industry again and again came up with this messaging that on the surface is very persuasive. I think, frankly, we were able to do a better job ultimately on the messaging, and that's because we came back to children's health. Again and again, we said, you know, these chemicals threaten our kids, and that was really a message that got through to government, certainly here in Ontario. I can tell you we met many times with the Minister of Environment here in Ontario, and he was very much persuaded by this. And I think finally what got through to him was the message that it wasn't worth taking the risk, that there were safe alternative ways, non-toxic ways for people to have a beautiful property. We didn't need to risk their health, and particularly kids' health, by using these poisons.
I'm talking to Gideon Foreman. He is the executive director of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. His organization was key to the passage of a proposition, and I guess I'm speaking Californian, aren't I, of a legislation that made it illegal to sell or apply pesticides for cosmetic lawn care in Ontario, California. And that's been in effect, Gideon, since April 2009, and the early returns are very encouraging. In fact, within a year, they were starting to see a decline. Those who were following this started to see a decline in the water, the levels of pesticides in the water, and measurable improvements almost right away. Is it an important part of the messaging to keep telling people about that?
Yeah, it was quite incredible, Angie. The Ministry of Environment here in Ontario looked at concentrations of pesticides, including 2,4-D, before the ban came into effect, that is in 2008, and after it came into effect in 2009. They compared concentrations of these toxic chemicals in urban streams. They looked at about 10 urban streams across Ontario, and they found some dramatic changes. After the ban came into effect, there were drops, there were reductions in some of these pesticides. So it's up to 94-97% even in common lawn care pesticides like 2,4-D and another one called dicamba. So it was really quite extraordinary after this ban came in just how quickly and how dramatically the concentrations of these toxic chemicals dropped. And I think it suggests that these bans are effective and they could be used in other places, including California. They would have quite dramatic results in short order.
What about enforcement? I mean, I'm sure that there was the specter raised of people spying on you in your homes and seeing what you're using and slapping you down. How does that actually play out?
Absolutely. The industry raised all these horror stories that they cooked up. You know, people will be spraying pesticides in the middle of the night and all this nonsense. What the polling showed, Angie, was that the broad sweep of the public in our province supported these bans. As I said, over 70%. When you have that kind of buy-in from people, when people want a piece of legislation, enforcement is not a problem. The province had to do a little bit of enforcement. There were a couple of people here and there fined and a couple of businesses. But for the most part, people wanted this legislation, so they followed it. And the industry, I must say to their credit, eventually did come around. The lawn care companies, lo and behold, were able to use the non-toxic products, the permitted products. And so enforcement really has not been a problem here in Ontario. And so what we're seeing is what we hoped for. People still have beautiful properties, but they're using non-toxic methods to keep them weed-free.
Gideon Foreman, congratulations on a job well done, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you. It was very much a collaboration with many groups, but thank you. We were happy to play a part.
And you'll find his organization online at www.cape.ca. Welcome back to In Deep. We have one more segment to talk about bee colony collapse, Monsanto, Bayer, pesticides, everything you need to know to get active on this sort of thing. And if you care to be active on this and related issues, I do strongly recommend you check out the Pesticide Action Network online. There's a link on our page at indeepradio.com. We're also on Facebook, In Deep with Angie Coiro. My guests, Paul Towers with the Pacific Action Network, and a journalist who's been covering these kind of topics for many years, Tom Philpott, who's currently working for Mother Jones Magazine. Tom, I want to make sure we get a little more into the super weeds that you were talking about, because the bee colony decline is one thing, and it's catastrophic in its nature if allowed to go much further. But these super weeds are only just starting to get some coverage. You were covering them as long as a year ago. And if I understand correctly, it's the combination of the genetically modified seeds and the pesticides that are allowing weeds to grow that are so thick, so resistant, and so strong that they can stop a combine in its tracks. Is that exaggerated?
No, that's exactly right. And I started writing about super weeds, I think, in 2009.
Wow.
And the problem of resistant weeds was something that was discussed at the time that these seeds were first released into the market in the mid-90s. This is not a problem that surprised anybody. And, you know, even though Monsanto claimed from the beginning that it would never be a problem, no serious person who looked at it, who understood the science, didn't think it was going to be a problem. And, you know, it's just basically basic science, basic evolution. If you take the same herbicide every year, so, you know, just to be clear, these crops are engineered to be able to stand this herbicide called Roundup, or glyphosate is its chemical name. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that a farmer can plant the seeds, the crop comes up, and can apply as much glyphosate as he or she wants throughout the growing season. And the glyphosate will kill all the weeds, what we call a broad spectrum herbicide, meaning that it kills all different kinds of weeds. And, but it won't affect the plant. And so all of a sudden, this thing that has been very difficult for farmers forever, controlling weeds, is suddenly extremely easy. You're able to just go through and spray your crop and have completely weed-free fields. And if you go to the Midwest now, during the corn season, like right now, you will see not a weed in sight, except for places where resistance is developed. Now, what happens is that a percentage of weeds have something about them, some gene or something about them that makes them not be affected by this glyphosate, this Roundup. And so they're the only ones left after the application. And it happens over and over again that they're the only ones after the application. And so this gene pool, the weed gene pool evolves to favor that whatever that gene is that makes it resist glyphosate. And so you get, it started in the South. I don't really understand why it started in the South, in cotton country, but that's where the first signs of resistance were. And, you know, I think that goes back to 2006, 2007, within 10 years of the release of the technology. And, you know, when it started to happen, Monsanto said, this isn't really a problem. It's an isolated thing. It won't be a problem. And meanwhile, as it's developing, farmers are increasing their dose of the chemical to kill these weeds, which is only intensifying this evolutionary pressure to evolve resistance. And by the time you get into 2009 in cotton country, you already are getting weeds like you just described, like these gigantic, thick weeds that you can't run a tractor over. And you know, getting into 2010, 2011, this starts happening in corn country in the Midwest. And so the response to this, I think, is truly scandalous. I remember reading in 2009 in the Farm Press in the South, the sort of newspapers and publications that farmers read about the problem, and the solution was always some kind of cocktail of herbicides. And so instead of so what you're getting there is this rain of all these different kinds of herbicides, including one that Paul mentioned called atrazine, which we know, there's a lot of science backing the idea up that in very small doses, when it gets in the groundwater, which it does, it harms both humans and frogs. And I think frogs are kind of a canary in the coal mine kind of a species. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge weight of science that shows that they negatively affect frogs' sexual development at very low levels. And then there's this building science, this kind of budding scientific literature that points to atrazine having effects on people, especially in terms of cancer. And so what you're getting from this technology that was supposed to solve the weed problem is it really ends up being just a great way to sell herbicides. The herbicide sales of Roundup exploded during this time. Now, around 2000, maybe Paul can step in and remind me of the time, but Monsanto's herbicide Roundup came off of patent. It had been patented before that because it's the only company that can make it.
Right.
And there's now cheap Chinese glyphosate coming into the market. Even with that, Monsanto is still selling. I believe sales are still over $1 billion a year in Roundup.
Well, it's such a well-known name. It's really permeated the market. Paul, I'm assuming that Roundup is here to stay, whether it has generic competition or not.
Yeah, I think Roundup is here to stay, and I think that's part of this, again, being stuck on this this pesticide treadmill is, again, GE or genetic engineering, genetically modified organisms. These crops, as Tom said, are meant to be really a pesticide sales device. So over the past 15 years, the only technology that Monsanto, the largest seed company, and others have been able to come up with is actually a way to actually sell more pesticides. Nothing's drought resistant. Nothing has increased really nutritional value of these crops. The idea is to allow more and more pesticides to be used. And that's what we've seen. Even with as the development of these with these super weeds, we've seen that now we're moving to other pesticide products that are meant to try and kill these weeds that have emerged in response to Roundup. And so now we're going back to this old arsenal of hazardous chemicals like 2,4-D. And what we're seeing is that not only are we adding 2,4-D to the mix, but which is a chemical being put on the market by Dow, Monsanto is now teaming up with Dow to keep Roundup in the mix. So we're seeing these stacked pesticide traits within these seeds. And now it's just a way for these even greater sort of consolidation within the seed and pesticide marketplace to sell and use more and more pesticides. So unfortunately, that's the current trajectory we're on, is greater consolidation, greater pesticide use with more genetic engineering. And that's bad news for Americans.
I am always in conversations like this. I always come to the same question, which nobody can answer, is don't these people have children? I mean, don't they care about subsequent generations? I can't believe what they're willing to pillage and plunder just for the money. But Tom, one of your articles that I brought up in the beginning of the show, and I want to make sure that we get to it, is entitled How Your College is Selling Out to Big Ag. And, this is about agriculture essentially buying into the research at the colleges and universities themselves. That goes hand in hand with the fact that if a research independent company comes up with, say, inconvenient truths about bee colony collapse, Monsanto can just buy them up as well. And I know we're harping on Monsanto, but it's the same behavior on behalf of any of the largest corporations. Tom, talk to us about this invasion of the research areas.
Well, I mean, I think it's a really key story that doesn't get told very often, and I don't think people give it quite enough weight. And that is that the United States in the 1860s, way back in the 1860s, realized that, like all nations realized, that food security, being able to grow enough food to feed people, is really important. And part and parcel of that is having a system in place to support farmers. And now the other thing about food production, whether it's organic or industrial, it can benefit from research. Organic farming systems in the United States, virtually a tiny percentage of the public money that goes into research goes into organic farming systems, and there's no doubt that organic farming systems could improve, they could become more efficient, but the research suggests isn't there. And what happened is this. The nation, Abraham Lincoln, puts the system in place that had become known as land-grant universities. He deeded land to every state in the United States, and those states were encouraged to sell that land and invest the money in an agricultural-based university. And to this day, every state in the union, even the newer states, have a land-grant university. Famous ones are Iowa State University, North Carolina State University, Texas A&M down in Texas, and New York State of Cornell. These are the land-grant universities. And the idea of them was to publicly funded research for the public good. And in order to get that research out to farmers, they started what they call the extension service that would sort of serve as a go-between between farmers and these researchers. And they were doing things like coming up with new strains of seeds that were more productive or had some adaptation for an area that was desirable for some reason. It wasn't always just productivity and yield that they were looking for. And the system worked pretty well for many, many decades. And then what you got in the 1980s was two different things. One, you had the leveling off of public funding for this research. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, fiscal crises, deficit crises and whatnot that slowed the growth in government spending for this research. The second thing you got, and I think the driver was more the pharmaceutical industry, was industry in general wasn't satisfied with what it was getting from universities in terms of basic research. There's this idea that there's all these ideas being generated on universities that aren't getting commercialized and put out into the public sphere. And so there was a bill in 1980 that basically made it possible for universities, including these land-grant universities, to commercialize their own research, encourage professors to work directly with industry, to accept funding from industry, and to do research that would be private in its scope. And so if you got a contract, you know, before 1980, public research on public universities was for the public domain. After 1980, if you're a professor, you can get a grant from a company or do research on your own, and then get a patent on that and benefit from it personally. And so those two things caused this great gusher of cash to come in. And I'm specifically talking about agriculture. I'm going to have a whole different conversation about pharmaceuticals. But it caused this great gusher of cash to come in to universities to fund research not for the public interest, not for things that are going to benefit farmers, to benefit everybody, but specifically that are going to benefit companies that are funding them.
Wow. Let me ask you guys before we conclude, and I'm going to have to ask you to keep your answers short. We're almost against the clock here, but we haven't really talked about the possibilities of organic farming, and I'm assuming that to be an organic farmer, it's almost as difficult to escape the effects of these pesticides and of the GMO seeds as if you were using them. Tom, you want to tackle that one?
Well, I think that organic farming has got a lot of potential, and you know it's already made pretty great strides if you consider that, you know, 20 years ago it was supplying less than 1% of food in the United States, and now it's up to, you know, something like 5%. You know, that's massive growth, but it's still only 5%, and the other 95 comes from these kinds of systems that Paul and I are talking about. And you know, I think that there's a couple of key points that I want to make about it. One is that the technology of organic farming is not stagnant and does not need to be stagnant. One of the industry talking points is that organic farming is 1930s farming or 1890s farming, when that's exactly wrong. There's plenty of room for innovation in figuring out how to grow, bountiful amounts of food without chemical inputs, or without, you know, very low amounts of chemical inputs. There's, it actually is a more intellectually interesting, endeavor than going out and plowing up 1,000 acres with a combine and planting Roundup Ready seeds and then hitting it with Roundup and then harvesting the same crop every year. In organic, you have to do things like crop rotations, innovative ways of mixing animal farming and crop farming to sort of close this nutrient loop, ways of bringing in beneficial insects, you know, figuring out ways of creating ecosystems in the farm where beneficial insects keep down populations of damaging insects by eating them, and so you're getting what we call biological pest control. If figuring out how to create robust ecosystems on farms is an extremely intellectually stimulating venture, and it could use lots and lots more research. If someone, you know, like I said, so we're at 5% of U.S. food is organic now, and about 1% of USDA's research budget goes to organic farming projects, meaning that it's way underfunded, even by, you know, by the standards of how much food is being produced by it.
And guys, you know what? That's where we have to end. I'm afraid we're really up against the clock here. So, but I really appreciate your time, both of you, and you've illuminated a lot of dark corners of this subject. Tom Philpott, great work for Mother Jones Magazine. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
And Paul Towers, I appreciate your work at Pesticide Action Network, and I hope we get a lot of clicks on your site from this show. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Angie.
And we do have a special bit of music to go out for. Paul had mentioned that there had been a protest earlier this week at Bear. Bear is about two blocks away from our studio in Berkeley, and we're fortunate enough to know some of the folks who are associated with the music. So we go out with a Bee protest song, and that comes to you from Nancy Schimmel and Judy Fiel, as sung by Judy. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro.
For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. For the peppers on your pizza and the cheese. You know that bees make honey, but the nectar's just the tease. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees.
Stick around for our next hour of In Deep. We'll be talking about the documentary on tort reform. It's called Hot Coffee. You know what case that is about. And as we go out for a break, you're hearing music from Nancy Schimmel and Judy Fiel. They were at the aforementioned protest in Berkeley against Bayer and their pesticides. This is sung by Judy Fiel. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep.
Pollen makes some people wheeze and sneeze. Well, the bees are so much neater, toting pollen on their knees. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. Hum a little hum, buzz a little buzz. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. Hum a little hum, buzz a little buzz. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. Flowers cannot go out on a date. They just have to sit around and wait. Until they get the pollen, they cannot set the seeds. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. Hum a little hum, buzz a little buzz. For every third bite you eat, thank the bees. Hum a little hum, buzz a little.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Coiro, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coiro. We'll see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.